I'm not Christiane Froman. Unfortunately, she's sick. She can't join us. So I'm sorry, but I will replace her. She has sent us a slideshow to display during the discussion, so we'll do it. So the last session is about protocols. I'm not sure that it's necessary to develop why we are going to speak about protocols, because I'm sure that Miriam, Marcello, Danny, and Gregor will be clearer than I to speak about the protocols. Olga, you're here. I'm waiting for you. No? So I'm just introducing Miriam Rasch. So she works for the Institute of Network Cultures at the University of Applied Sciences in Amsterdam. She's Olga. I'm just finishing introducing Miriam. Miriam, you want to say something?
God. Yeah, but it's in my notes. Sorry, finish this.
Okay,
and
okay.
I will just say it at the end.
She's responsible for INC publications and works as a researcher on projects around hybrid publishing and net criticism. Alongside this, she teaches philosophy and media theory. She's going to speak about text from a post-digital world, and she's a writer as well. So please join me to welcome Miriam.
Okay, thank you. Is this working and on? Yes. Okay, thanks for inviting me. Ah, there it is again. Here you see a picture of my desk at home, which is kind of, I guess, an image of the post-digital world with the laptop and paper books and a lot of post-its and some personal icons that help me writing. So who am I? I'm Miriam, as has been said. I have a background in literature and philosophy. And I work at the Institute of Network Cultures, which is indeed at the University of Applied Science. So we do applied research and not so much the real academic research, which I like a lot because it enables me to do different things than just writing academic texts. So next to my job, I'm also writing as a, well, more like a freelance person. I write, does this work? No. I will write book reviews and essays, and actually next week my first book is coming out, and it's so exciting. And here you see the cover, and maybe you can guess a little what it says and what it's about. Swimming in the Ocean, Text from a Post-Digital World is the subtitle to the book and the title to my talk here. And all the essays are about the internet, digital culture, and stuff like that. So today I'm going to talk about new forms of writing that digital technology kind of enables and makes available to us. And I think on the one hand, this leads to a question of new formats and technologies. And this is a question that we develop a lot in the Institute and our research there. But I'm also interested more in my own work in the question how digital technology kind of influences or affects the language we write in as, well, literary but also colloquial writers. So to start with our INC project on art criticism, this is a project where we really dive into new formats for writing, in this case about art criticism. It's a project which is a Dutch-Flemish collaboration with Publishing Lab, Institute of Network Cultures, the Domain for Art Criticism, Laboratory of Contemporary Art Criticism, and Recto Verso is a Flemish cultural magazine. And just to say also up front, mostly I write in Dutch myself, and this is also a Dutch project, but I guess it's going to be clear what it's all about. So in the Art Criticism project, we develop tools for making new forms of art criticism possible. And of course, that is with the idea to kind of revitalize art criticism in tough times. So here's an example of a masterclass slash workshop that we did in May, so about a month ago. It was called Cross Critique, and it happened in Brussels. And it was really focused on visual forms of art criticism. And you can find the results on the website of Recto Verso. And I won't really go a lot into this because I want to talk mainly about text. So here's another example of a project we did within the bigger art criticism project. It's called Edit Disposed, and it's all about collaborative writing of art critique. So what is this? If you go to the website, you can actually go into this example. So the tool is built on the application called Etherpad. Maybe you know about it. And it's developed by a design studio that we work a lot with. They're called Template from Rotterdam. And what you do is everyone gets online and opens this Etherpad purpose application and can write on an art critique. And in this case, we did it with in a collaboration with a festival called Moving Futures, which is a dance festival. So each night after the show, the dance show, members from the audience, together with an art critic called Manu Schoene, he's also mentioned there, got together and wrote a critique about the show. And then afterwards, here you can see there is a built-in like PDF generator, which is, well, not just the same as pressing print, but you get this very nicely made PDF and you can print it and bring it back home. So we were also sitting there in the lobby of the theaters with the printer and everything. So, of course, this is really about researching collaborative writing. And I guess collaborative writing, especially in the arts, it has a long history and a lot of experimentational history. But especially with the whole Etherpad solution, it's really possible to write like at sentences or even words together at the same time, which is kind of special, I think. And this leads quite directly to what we call multi-voiced critique, which you think is something for the future of art criticism. Okay, next project is something that I'm working on with one of the oldest literary magazines from the Netherlands. It's called De Gids. And these are the internet gids cahiers, which means they are kind of experimental e-books, cahiers, which we make together with the literary magazine. But the idea is that everything that is published within this series cannot be published in the paper magazine. So it's both an experiment and it's a way of expanding kind of the scope of the magazine. So here we see the first two editions. The first reality essay, you can read about it. It's a kind of semi-fictional autobiographical essay by Dirk Vis, who was in a reality show on television. And the other one, the one on the right hand, is Sonja Schulte, Vlieland. And it's also, I was already talking to someone about this newly evolving genres, because I guess a lot of what we hear is kind of defying the genres that we know, and the same goes for this. It's also an autobiographical kind of travel report accompanied by audio and drawings. And the audio and drawings were both done by the author herself. obviously, well, a drawing you can have in a print magazine, but the audio not. So this is a way for us to see, yeah, how can you expand the literary forms when you take the ebook as the starting point. And these are sold, just to mention that, because I agree that maybe we should also talk about revenue models. These are sold in the web shop in a pay what you want model. So we're not sure how it's going to turn out, but we'll see. And the next one, this is something that's also in the reader, in my research notes. The next one of these Dig Cahiers, so number 3, will be a title that is written by me. Again, a new elusive kind of genre. I call it a fictitious smartphone essay. And it's an essay that is actually written specifically for the smartphone format. So the idea is that people read this on their smartphone. And what I try to find out is how this notion affects the way that I write myself. And not just about anything. I chose the topic that I wanted to write about a long time, and which I think really fits this new form of smartphone writing, which is friendship. Because, of course, the smartphone is sharing, being online, it's all about new forms, or degradating, maybe, friendship. And I guess the smartphone is our BFF. So how does that work? Sorry, it's also in Dutch. So if you want to read it, learn Dutch or wait for a translation. Let me just see if I don't forget anything. No, this is actually not in the book, because this was written specifically for the e-book format. And this goes on with 40 screens like that. That's why it's called 40. So this question that I asked myself, how does specific technology change the way we write? It's something that I tried before to do with another technology, so to speak, which is the Facebook update. And I had that. This is in English, so you can go to Tor. I tried to download it again yesterday because I didn't have it on my laptop, but it didn't work. But, well, who knows? It's kind of a short story slash, well, semi-fictitious, I don't know. The editors of the magazine where it was published, The Tourist, called it a prose poem, so I was really happy about that, but I would never call it a prose poem myself. And in it, I try to take the Facebook update as a technology and see what happens when we kind of bring in darkness, because the shadow book means the Facebook update from the dark side of the world. I'm kind of just giving examples, and then maybe we can talk about it later to see what is most interesting. Here are two other examples which are in the book, and one is about, it's called Notes Towards a Spreadsheet Novel. So I'm really fascinated by the spreadsheet and Excel as a way of understanding the world and how we make sense of it. Can we write a novel like that? And the one on the right is an essay also about the smartphone. And here is an essay also from the book, which was translated into English for the INC long form series. So I'm really happy about that. And it's called The Post-Digital Condition. It's the opening essay of my book. And I kind of took this name of the post-digital to position myself. And I'm not sure if I really like the word, but that is also something I would want to talk about. I think the way I understand what the post-digital is about, it's the phase that we're in now, where we have lived through the whole digitalization which kind of means that everything is made quantifiable, measurable, translated into data. And so digital in the sense of being made measurable and countable. And the post-digital condition means we have to deal with that. And how do we do that? And that is actually where I want to go from here. How can we find words and language and literary forms to deal with us as humans being datafied even more and more and more? I don't know if you read the book by Yuval Harari. He's kind of like a hype in the Netherlands, and he proclaims humans are algorithms. And if you don't agree with that fully, like I don't want to agree with that fully, how can we find words and language to disagree with that? And just to end up, I want to name a Jamaican poet who I saw speak in Rotterdam not too long ago. His name is Ishion, I don't know exactly, Hutchinson, and he really made a call to find this language which kind of stands up against the bureaucratic narrowing that is being rolled over our heads. And I think it's not only essential that we do that with the bureaucratic narrowing, but also with the narrowing in the name of data. So that's it. Thanks.
Maybe we can have a short conversation with you now. No, you can stay here. I'm just wondering what are the main ideas of your essay on the literature and the web, and what do you mean exactly by this word "and," not within or in, or well, why have you chosen the word "and"?
That's a really good question. I think I didn't even choose it very consciously, because you're referring to what is above the title, and that is kind of like the WordPress category. So, which is already interesting, because WordPress forces you to choose a category. But since I'm the one doing all this, I could make up my own category. And I think why I would now reason that I chose that is because the essay is very much about literature in print of our days, and then also like not avant-garde or experimental literature, but Knausgaard. I don't know if you know him. I think he's popular everywhere. And Sheila Haiti, which is a U.S. novelist. So mostly about them and a Dutch poet. But they are not publishing in the digital domain or only online or stuff like that. They're writing books and they are in the bookstore. But I try to read the trends that I see in those novels and the poetry within the post-digital context. So I think that some things that are quite remarkable or strange or weird in the work of these authors can be kind of understood better when you look at it as coming out of a post-digital world. So it's literature and the web, because the literature in this case is not on the web or in the web.
Hi, thank you for that. I have a question about really your last, the question you posed to the audience, how does the digital affect writing or affect literature, I think was how you ended. And I was wondering, because the two examples, or two of the examples you showed, use completely opposite strategies, right? You started with the Etherpad kind of multi, you called it multi-voice, which is I mean, there's a lot of talk about collaborative writing and in the end somehow a dissolving of the author subject in a multiplicity. On the other hand, the internet Ries texts seem to be highly autobiographical, which is also something you could see, the ease of publishing, which is basically the point of this conference, right, is the threshold for publishing is so low that anyone can do it. So you have somehow these two trajectories. Either the voices become entangled to a degree that they are indistinguishable, or they're highly autobiographic and they're instantaneous and you just tweet your life and so on. How do you bring these two together? What is digital about those completely different approaches to writing and to the auctorial position?
Well, to start, I would say that everyone who's tweeting their lives is not especially doing literary writing. So I think that would be something else. And what kind of brings the two together, because you're correct, it's really amazing that those two strands go parallel. But on the other hand, in the Etherpad situation, the single author is dissolved and you don't know who wrote what word even. But it's not that in the other strand there are highly autobiographical texts. I think what is interesting about those are that they are semi-biographical or semi-autobiographical. So the guy who wrote about the reality essay, he wrote about his own experience in a reality show, but the whole point of the essay is that it's like in reality. I mean, a reality show is scripted, of course. So it's not real, it's not real reality. It's some kind of mediatized entertainment form of reality. And that is what he tries to do in that book. And also with the other one, it's an autobiographical kind of travel report, but it's punctuated by travel reports that she's reading. So that's what you hear also. As for my own two, so the shadow book and the smartphone essay, I know what's autobiographical about them, but they are not, I would not call them totally autobiographical or very much so. It's more like, it's not certain what is and what isn't. Just like with the Etherpad critique, where it's not certain what came from whom. That's what, at least what I think is interesting in this time of writing. I also, in the essay that is online, I go back to David Shields, I guess you all know him, and his Reality Hunger, so the book that is composed of quotes and that is kind of bringing out the message, you know, there's no fiction or non-fiction or autobiography or memoir or whatever. It's you can't tell anymore. So I'm inspired by that.
Maybe one last question for this first round of question, Vincent Broca.
It's not exactly a question, but it brings to mind what you were saying. Brings to mind the extraordinary book and poem by Robert Fitterman, whose title I never quite remember correctly. It's something like "No, yep, wait, still definitely hate myself." And it's a repurposing of a post-conceptual book, and it's a repurposing of posts of people who on forum, who people expressing their nostalgia, melancholy, or, you know, being ill at ease in the world. So they post these posts. And he did this project particularly because he claims that once he saw that someone, in order to express his or her, I think his you know, feeling of being ill at ease in the world, used a post from someone else, verbatim. And so his subjectivity was expressed by the sheer act of repurposing under his name the the post of someone else. So this connects the issue of the collective and the individual. And of course, what Robert Fitterman does in the book is that he uses, so he pastes all the posts that he massages into his form, and he only uses the pronoun I. So it's a big I, collective I, and this questions the notions of, you know, what is a subjectivity on these, you know, so-called social media, and how do you express your so-called feelings, and your, are they fictional, are they real, are they, you know, intertextual, what are they?
Thanks, that sounds really interesting. I'm going to ask you if you can find the title for me. And just as a short response, I think I'm very much struggling with the idea that the I should kind of dissolve in I don't know what, because me as a writer, I want to express myself, you know, and I see in everyone that I work with, everyone still wants to do that, but maybe you use someone else's post or you use another technology or whatever. But I'm not completely sure that there's not really this. I mean, it's hyper expression, but
it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Well,
to come back to David Shields again, because I guess he's now in my mind. Of course, it's also what he tries to find out, right? I mean, he composes this whole book made up of quotes and passages from other people with some of his own in between. But the whole book is his message. So it's still something that he wants to express and that he is going to talk about and that he is going to discuss with other people. So, yeah. But thanks.
Thanks, Miriam. We are now moving forward to Marcello Vitali Rossati's presentation. Marcello is an associate professor at the Department of French Literature, Université de Montréal, and he holds the Canada Research Chair in Digital Textualities. He studied philosophy and literature and gained his PhD from the University of Pisa in Italy and the University of Paris for La Sorbonne. I don't know where La Sorbonne is. He's going to speak about editorialization, writing, and producing spaces.
Thank you very much. Could you put the slides on? Does it work?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, wonderful. So I have to use the wireless mic because I am not able to stand still. So could you put the presentation on? So thank you very much to Lionel and to all the organizers for inviting me. I'm really, really excited to be here. So first of all, speaking about subjectivity and the will of express ourselves, I really like to express myself, but here I'm talking as a collective. So this morning we were saying that we never write alone, and I think we never think alone. So this is my the team of my lab, and when I'm saying I in this presentation, actually I'm talking about everybody. Especially I want to mention Servan Monjour, who is a postdoctoral student with me, Nicolas Sauré, Enrico Agostini, and Marie-Christine Corbeil, who are really involved in the projects I'm going to present. So think that the intelligent things they have thought about, and the stupid, it's me. So few theoretical statements, and then some practical projects I want to present, and I hope the practical projects will demonstrate or illustrate at least my very large theoretical statements. First one: we live in a digital space. I tried to represent this statement with my patchwork. What I want to mean with this statement is that the very space in which we live, or perhaps better, these spaces, I added an S after reading Lionel's paper about publishing sphere, and I think he's right. So these spaces in which we live are, I will give this definition, a set of heterogeneous relationships between connected or non-connected objects. So I try to think the space, but the very material space is not a metaphor of space. Our very material space, the room where we are, the territory where we are, a city or whatever, are a set of heterogeneous relationships between different kind of objects. So we have chairs, we have table, we have persons, we have lights, and we have computers, and we have connection, internet connection. So I think a space is something like that. And so it is hybrid, it is heterogeneous, and I don't think we can actually make all the time the difference between what is digital and what is not. I don't like actually the word digital. I think we will leave this word in some, perhaps post-digital is a right expression to the to say what I mean here. It is material. So here I think I agree with Lionel and the idea of I don't want to idealize the space, and I think that we can think about merging of what Habermas was thinking opposing spaces and sphere, so public spaces and public sphere. I think we have to think them together. I hope I'll explain better with my examples. And another concept I think it's useful to understand this idea of space is the one of nomos, or perhaps the plural nomoi, used by Carl Smith, for instance, in his book Land and Sea. A space is an order of things which carries values. And it is the very material structure of space carries values, and it expresses an order and an organization of things which reflect a vision of the world. So this is what nomos means. Second statement, the concept of editorialization, which is a concept on which I have been working with a collective of scholars, first of them Gérard Vomser, Francophone scholars, and I think this concept can help us to understand what digital space is and what our space is at the time of digital. So I define editorialization, we define editorialization as a set of dynamics that produce and structure digital space or space in general. These dynamics can be understood as the interactions of individual and collective actions within a particular digital environment. I mean, I hope that in my examples it will be clearer, but the idea is, okay, when we organize space, on when a space is organized, it depends on the interaction of a lot of actors, so people and things and so on, but also algorithms, platform, databases, users' actions, and practices. My patchwork in the background means perhaps when I'm what's Berlin? Berlin is a set of dynamics which produce relationships between things. I can so it is streets and some people and some buildings, but also it is all you are seeing behind. So what I can find on Google about Berlin, the map of Berlin, the metro infrastructure, and actually the digital infrastructure is merged with the non-digital or pre-digital infrastructure. And to understand a space is to understand the merging of these plural layers. So editorialization is about organizing not organizing contents like edition. So this is perhaps the main difference between edition and editorialization. Edition is about organizing contents. Editorialization is about structuring and organizing the word itself. When I write something on a platform, TripAdvisor, about a restaurant, for instance, what I'm doing is that I'm producing the position, I'm contributing to position the restaurant, so its visibility, for instance, and so on. But the problem is, if our space is also made by digital infrastructures, and it's what we see all the time, if when I arrive in Berlin, the first thing I do, I use my smartphone in order to know where I am and where is the closest restaurant. I'm not hungry like now. I don't know why I'm speaking about restaurants all the time. when we do that, we understand immediately that this space is not completely free, and there are a small group of actors which contribute mainly to its production. So the GAFAM group is just an exemplification. I could have put Airbnb or some other actors, but mainly the question is who owns this space. So the problem is that we are living in a space that it is more and more produced by a little bench of private corporations, which has a very important, very strong power in structuring our space. So, okay. This is, in my opinion, the main, I'm not citing all the scholars thinking about that, so Morozov is one of the most cited today, but Grecht has written about that, and many, many people did. So I just want to tell you about two projects of the chair in digital textualities, which I think can illustrate what this theoretical claims. So two projects. The first one is the project TransCan says. So it's a project about TransCanada highway. And we tried to editorialize TransCanada Highway. And the second one is Sens Public, which is a journal founded by Gérard Vomser in 2003. And I'm going to, I hope, to speak briefly about both of them. So the challenge was to editorialize the TransCanada Highway. You know, the TransCanada Highway is a set of highways going from east to west in Canada. So it's a kind of mythic Canadian road. And the conference, so there is a conference of humanities in Canada each year, and it is each year in a different location. And the last year it was in Calgary. So the first thing, I'm always attending, so the first thing is to say, okay, we are going to the conference in Calgary. And the second thing was, okay, how will we reach Calgary? So first reflex of it with my team was, okay, let's Google it. And we Googled it. And Google answered by plane. So just if you Google Montreal, we are based in Montreal. So Montreal to Calgary, just you have this straight line on Canada, and you have to take a plane. So the possibility of taking a car was not proposed by Google. So we said, okay, it's a quite interesting thing, because Google is saying to us that there is one possibility, the best one, and the other one, it's not really interesting to cross the prairies by car. So if you want to look at the prairies, just look to Google View. It's a good way to see Hawk, rest of Canada, according to Quebecois, there is Quebec and the rest of Canada. It's a kind of territory which is completely empty. And so the question that we are asking ourselves was, what's this space? This space separating Montreal from Calgary. It is kind of, on one hand, we had all this perception that it was an empty space. So some people of my team are European. So for Europeans, what is between Montreal and probably Vancouver is kind of an empty space. And for Quebecers, is the same things. So we were always saying, okay, there's nothing over there. Why would you possibly want to go there? And on the other hand, we realized that there was a very, very full of things space, which was the digital one. So if you wanted to zoom in with Google Maps, for instance, but with Wikipedia, Airbnb, TripAdvisor, whatever you want, you could find something very, very precise, and the space is really full. But full of what? Full of what these platforms want to put there. So we had it's the very space, the very material space, was not the space of our imagination, nor the space of our car crossing the Canada, but it was the space of the digital platforms. So this was kind of challenging to us, and we wanted to try to challenge this idea and to find out other solutions. So what is the relationship between digital and non-digital space? That was one question. And the other question was, what's the role of literature in all of that? Because, okay, if this space is produced with the digital technologies also, how it is filled? Can we fill this space with literature, for instance, and with what kind of literature? So is there a role of literature in producing this space? There were a lot of intertextualities about that. I cited just a few of them. The first one was Cortázar et Dunlop, Les Autonautes de la Cosmoroute. Cortázar et Dunlop made a trip from Paris to Marseille by car in a month. Stopping, they never quitted the highway, but they stopped at each parking in the highway in order to challenge the structure of the highway. And what we wanted to do now, we thought that the infrastructure to challenge was not the highway, but was first mainly the digital structure. So we wanted to do actually the same thing, but challenging digital infrastructure. And Savelia Menard, Pierre Menard, made a book on the same trip recently, using also Google Maps. So Google Street View and the car trip and the train trip, and they merged all these layers together. So we were inspired by Raffman, and it was one of our inspirations. So the idea was, how can we take back this space to us and become again actors of the production of the production of this space, and without leaving it to some digital private companies. So what did we find in this empty space? So what we discovered, that TransCanada Highway is an editorialized object which is made of digital and non-digital maps. So this is one layer. I won't list all of them, but just to give you an idea, there are narratives making this space. What was interesting was that we stopped at all libraries that we could find, and we found a lot of books which are not mainstream book in Canada, especially the Ontarian Francophone literature. So you could think that there is no Francophone literature if you look at the rest of Canada from Quebec. You think that there is Quebec, speaking in French, and then the rest of Canada speaking in English. And there are a lot of things that popped up during our trip, and so we discovered that all this space has been produced also by narratives which are made by minorities. Images, a lot of them, people, a lot of people making this space, a lot of motels, motels and buildings and stuff like that, and all an imaginary of motels which goes together. So you have the imaginary part and the so-called material part, which are merged together. You cannot see motels if you don't have narratives and images and so on. Restaurants. This is a kind of a poutine of Ontario. Writings. Our writings, what we were writing during the trip, using Twitter, Facebook, writing fake TripAdvisor, just to create other narratives, using TripAdvisor in order to make literature. This is kind of I think Gert would call it a tactical media or something. So try to détourner, hijacking the platforms, blogs, postcards, and you see the reference to Rothman. One of us, Servan, stayed in the lab in Montreal, and she made the trip on Google Street View, trying to find some images in Rothman style. A lot of stories. We were saying this morning that space is there is a storytelling for building the space. Readings, a lot of them. This is the house of Gabriel Roy, a very famous Francophone Canadian writer who was born here in Winnipeg. And communities. François is not here, but he was, and he wasn't with us, but he was with us because he was tweeting all the time, following us in the trip. And there was a huge community of people who we know or not, coming with us and helping us to produce this space, to give a sense and an organization to this space, putting online songs, for instance. Ah, okay, you are there. I heard the song about this. Here is the song. So an organization of the space. This was one project. I have 1 minute to present the other one. I'm very sad, but Sens Public is a journal, and it has been created by Gérard Vomser. It's a journal which wants to be a public space. So the idea is what the function of the journal, and in this case is a scholarly journal, but the main goal is not to disseminate knowledge. If you want to disseminate knowledge, you just put it online on your blog and it's okay. The function of a journal is more to create a public space, which is a very material space, but it is at the same time a public sphere. So that was the purpose, the goal of Gérard in 2003. And today we are trying to rethink the editorial object because since 2003 a lot of things have changed. And so this space is a set of relationships, as I defined the space before, between people writing papers or people writing annotations or comments or tweeting about the papers and so on, or people cited in the bibliography, for instance, papers, for sure, concepts, so keywords or a concept, a main concept of the paper, resources of all kind. I mean, videos of a conference which has inspired a paper, and then an annotation of somebody, and so on. So it is a real space, just as the salon in Habermas' definition. But so it is material because we actually meet in there, and we can do stuff. So the important thing is not what kind of texts circulate in this space. The texts are just some objects which allows the structure of a space, the organization of a space where we can meet and do things. And in this sense, I hope what we are trying to do with both this project is to create, to produce a public space or some public spaces, because you can have a plurality of them. And and that's, I think, should be the purpose of digital publishing. Thank you very much.
Do you want to take one or two questions now?
If you want, yeah.
Yeah, Hannes Gert. I think I'm... who was the first? Hannes, maybe.
Okay.
I've seen you first.
Thank you very much for this. Can you hear me? Is this... Yeah, okay. I have a very basic question, and maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but what kind of concept of space do you use? Right, that traditionally there are at least two types of space. You have absolute and relational space. The absolute space is Newtonian, the relational is Leibnizian or Eulerian. And I always find that question interesting when talking about the public, because relational space is very useful in order to talk about the internet. Because the relational space is, for instance, the space a network creates, right? Whereas the absolute space is the space that we're in. So when you talk about material space, when you say space as relationships, also includes space as material or real, then these are two different types of space, at least in the history of philosophy, right? So this is, for instance, I mean, I worked on the public, the concept of the public in Hannah Arendt, and she uses the agora, right? The actual meeting place in the Greek polis, which has the problem that it cannot really account for medial publics. This is why Habermas is so important, because Habermas dematerializes the public space, even though he talks about the salon, etc. But the reading public is different than the public that we create at this moment. So I'm just wondering how can the relational and the absolute space interact if they are somehow on two different plans?
Thank you. It's the question, and perhaps I don't have an answer, but I'm working on. I really think that this is I think the main goal of my theoretical work is to try to combine both of these definitions. So I didn't explicitate that because of time. So I just pitched the the statement without explaining it. But I think Carl Schmitt. So that was my reference. Carl Schmitt is a quite good way in order to think about that, and a better way. So here I owe to Enrico Agostini, who is a PhD student of me, with me, and who is working on this topic, and especially is making a critique of Lefebvre conception of space, saying that actually the problem of Lefebvre conception is that it stays idealized and it forget. It is a very Marxist way of thinking about space. So there is still an opposition between what is infrastructure, which is serious, and what is symbolic stuff, which is less serious. So Lefebvre has all the time this kind of... And Schmitt tries to put them together, saying that, okay, it is you cannot separate the very structure, the very material structure of spaces from the values it carries. And the idea of nomos, I think it's a quite a good idea, because nomos is actually a material order. It's how you put stuff on a real space. So it's this kind of organization. And if you have this kind of organization, you have values which pop up from this. So I know that it's not an answer, but it's just you put the finger in the sensible spot. But I think it is possible to merge these two opposite conceptions of absolute and symbolic space. And I think it's what we have to do in order not to think of the net, because we have thought about the network also as an immaterial thing, exactly saying that, it's relationships, but it is discursive relationships and so on, but it is not true, because this kind of relationships are written, and if you look at, we had this discussion with Gert some years ago, citing Galloway, for instance, and the work Galloway has made about protocols. If you look at protocols, if you look at standards, so if you look at how HTML is done and so on, you can see that there is a very material aspect. The other thing is how we define what material is, which is a very complicated and problematic word. I think probably we should just abandon the word material, or at least think material like material forces in physics, and not material like something you can touch, because yes, you can touch it's kind of vague. Right. So that's right. A beginning of an answer, but thank you for the question.
Gert Loving?
Yeah, I'm really inspired by this road trip. It opens up a lot of possibilities, I think, for an entire new genre. And tomorrow I will speak a bit more about developing of new genres and formats, because maybe this has the potential to rewrite, to open up the road trip, because that genre is I wouldn't say dead, but it's quite very traditional. It hasn't really it has created a lot of beautiful stories, but it no longer matches with how people actually travel these days. Now, my question there goes in the direction of if you could maybe distinguish a bit more about, let's say, the partiality of the platforms in comparison to the claims, of totality. Of the experience that we make, right? You listed a whole number of quite great platforms. You sit there and they come to you, right? TripAdvisor, Google Earth, Google Maps. You search, but also you get a lot. Social media, right? There's a very, very diverse flow of what in the past was called partial media, let's say. One comes up with a song, the other comes up with a tweet, the next one finds a video. Do you see that this will be our experience for the time being, or do you sense that there is a kind of a longing or a point where the Wagnerian Gesamtkunstwerk can also be reached, right? I mean, is the multimedia experience as the unique experience reachable, or are we just lost in this multiplicity of data?
It's a quite complicated question. I don't know if if you should wish to have this unique experience.
It was the idea in the 19th century, right? This was the summit of the artistic experience. Yeah.
I think that there are two points in your question. One is the possibility of making sense of something, of our experience, for instance. So that is kind of, in the middle of all this multiplicity, can I understand something and share something with somebody else? So this is, I think, a very important thing. on one hand, but on the other hand, there is the risk of a monopolization of experience made by a few companies. So I think we should look at both these things. So we want to make sense, but we want the possibility of having plurality over there, so having plural meanings and plural senses. So I think that what we was trying to do in the TransCanada project was to produce our own collective meaning, making sense together, and something which was shared by a communities and understood by a community, and which was unique and understandable as a unity. So this is our TransCanada's highway, and our, which is quite open, because our, if you want to share with us, you can, because we kind of explain how it is structured and how it is produced. On the other hand, we wanted to avoid the fact of saying, okay, this space, the sense of this space is Google Map. And this is a unique experience, and you have to share it, and you have no possibility of doing something else. So this was what we were trying to do. So to make a collective sense without accepting a unique sense produced by only. I mean, I don't have this fear about Google. It's just an example, but there is a problem over there about, okay, it is really prescriptive and really present. So can we make sense, which is shareable, but in another, in different ways? So I think this is my answer.
Last question for this one, Margaret.
The Road movie is dead at all. If you look at Iran and China, it's having a massive, not rebirth, but it's alive and well and kicking. And I think that might be an interesting way, sideways look for you. But my real question is, how does your work intersect with that of Marc Auger and the idea of the highway as being a non-place of supermodernity filled with anonymous humans? Are you in antagonism with that?
I think yes. In general, it feels difficult to me to understand what Marc Auger was saying about non-places, because I don't see any non-places anywhere. It has been years I trying to understand that, but if you are in Montreal Airport, is not the same as Berlin Airport, and it's so full of stuff. Perhaps today is different because of digital. I don't know if digital localized more. I don't know. But, you know, when you arrive in Berlin, you have your phone which pops up with the restaurants, actually, where you can go to eat. And they are not in Montreal, you know. Because if they were in Montreal, I can trash my iPad because it is unuseful. So I think, and the experience we made doing the TransCanada Highway, even if the connection was not always there. You know, you pass through some very empty place, actually, we can say that. So we had bear traversing our road, and Orignon, I don't know the name, a moose. There was no connection. But at the same time, it was not at all a known place, because it was very characterized by panels with or without bilingual indications, signals, you know, or with First Nations signals, or libraries on the road speaking in French in the middle of an Anglophone zone. So, you know, it was really, really characterized and really different. And what was interesting was actually that, yes, you can see it as a known place if you look at it from Google Maps, like, you know, the straight line, take the plane if you want to go there. But when you are there, it is not a known place. It is full of things. So, I think it's... I am really in opposition about this idea. Perhaps works in some cases, but not in my experience.
Okay, thanks. And just for this reference to Marc Auger, a couple of months ago in France was released a major criticism of non-places, and the title of the book of Michel Lussault is Hyper-Places, and it's a very good book. Thanks. So we're moving forward to Danny. Dennis Nelson, we've heard him this morning. That was fantastic. And he's back. So it's fantastic. Maybe I introduce you, because you haven't been introduced this morning. So Danny is a writer, an editor, an archivist. Yes, his online editorial work can be found on UbuWeb, Pensound, Eclipse, and the EPC. He's the publisher at Edit Publication, and has just been hired as an assistant professor in UCLA. That's right. That's right. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Can you hear me okay on this? Is this coming through? Yeah? Okay. Great. So, yes, I'm glad to be back. I think it was very nice to open the day and to almost be closing it. I was just sitting back there thinking my mind was so full of all these beautiful ideas that I desperately needed a jolt of caffeine or some coffee or something. But luckily, Marcello spoke, and I felt like I immediately was revived from my intellectual reverie. And so I will try to maintain some semblance of that energy, as I know it is getting late on in the day. But it is a great pleasure to be here to share some lines and to wear another hat. So instead of a manic poet jumping through a wide variety of documents, I'm going to be rather academic, and actually will be reading from a script here. So bear with that. I'll be talking about protocol, digital formats, and poetics with you today. The project I'm working on places the study of contemporary digital media in conversation with the history of 20th century poetry, art, and cinema through the variable afterlives of works circulating online. So in stark distinction to many of the presentations here, I'm primarily concerned with forms of republication or republishing of historical works into contemporary digital environments, and the variable effects that this republishing has on historical work and on the present. This will be primarily focused on methodology or a framework, so I'm hoping to import a phrase or two that might be useful in thinking about digital publication, which is, I think, to say publication more generally today. First, I can just sort of outline my primary objects of study. This is part of my bio. But I've been looking at four what I'm calling little databases. These are collections of digital artifacts online. The first of which I look at is called text.com. It operated primarily in plain text ASCII format. It was a NetArt library operant from 1999 to about 2003. Geert is prominently featured in the collection. It was taken down through some copyright claims from the Adorno estate. But you can imagine this is a kind of collection of like all the really hip, like a hip hacker with like Marxist leanings, like all the texts that they would want to have. So Guy Debord is in there, and Kathy Acker, and Douglas Adams, etc., what have you. About 538 plain text files. I also look at a website called Eclipse. And here I was focused on the GIF format, very peculiarly Eclipse, which is a collection of radical small press publications from the last quarter century, actually used the GIF format as an archival form. So it digitized Language magazine, for example, one of the most influential avant-garde magazines of poetics from the last quarter century, as a series of GIFs. So I've been interested in what that means. Pensound, again, I think I wanted to put these websites up, if you don't know them, as a kind of plug for resources. They're all free, online, and accessible. Text.com only through archive.org, but nevertheless, still accessible. Pensound operates in the MP3 format. It hosts about 30,000 recordings of poets reading as MP3s, again, a very bad archival standard. And then UbuWeb, perhaps the messiest and worst archival project, the kind of sprawling database of the avant-garde. Here I'm particularly interested in its use of flash video. Again, flash video as an archival format, I think, should make the archivists in the room shudder. I'll get into that a bit more shortly. So while I'm studying these collections, which I'm calling little databases, I also work for them. I began as a scanner for Eclipse in 2004, an editor for UbuWeb in 2006, and a PenSound editor in 2008. Over the past decade, I've been working to build these collections while also studying their role in contemporary scholarship and creative practices. The more I examined these collections, the more I became convinced of the transformative dimensions of the file format itself, a kind of protocol for internet use. In particular, I studied the effects of digital formats represented here, and focused on how these file formats impacted the historical works of writing, sound, and cinema. So the historical works I analyze are assembled in these online collections that I'm calling little databases for reasons I'll outline further on. Primarily, I guess what I want to argue is that the online versions of historical works that we encounter are not only transformed every single time we use them, but that these versions or republications transform our understanding of each historical work in turn. And I'll get to some specific examples in a moment. But with that overview, over the next 15 minutes or so remaining, I suppose, I'll be sharing a range of tactics for approaching the research I'm currently conducting on paper and through creative works. First, I'll be introducing some key concepts and methodologies for my broader project on the little database. Put most succinctly, I guess, my research investigates the ways in which historical works of writing, sound, and moving image, that is also to say books, records, and films, are transformed by digital formats. At the same time, this methodology pursues modes of creative scholarship, as demonstrated earlier, conducted in and among the media platforms we study. I argue that these objects of study necessitate scholarly approaches that perform and unfold within the digital environments they analyze. I'll talk about that a bit more as well. But to begin with, I want to talk about the little database. And I was glad that small data came up earlier, perhaps a kind of kin term. I've been using the term little database for two reasons. First, of course, as a kind of deliberate counter to big data. I chose this image here, which seemed to be to neatly encapsulate big data with geopolitics, stock markets, and a strangely mechanical human mind, all in the well-discussed computer blue aesthetic. This was actually drawn from a spam website and is, I think, currently the top Google image search when you put in big data. The image, I think, perfectly reflects certain new developments in the digital humanities, which often borrow from the data-driven strategies of governmental agencies like the NSA and the corporate world alike. Big data, in short, stakes its hopes for meaningful interpretation on the parsing of enormous amounts of data. For many, its logic is consistent with state surveillance, corporate data mining, and systems of informatic control. In other words, protocol. And here I suppose, as we were just saying a moment ago, it's sort of obligatory to cite Alex Galloway in any panel on protocol. And his thought on the subject was very influential to me at a certain moment, but simultaneously seems absolutely limiting, I think, in the present, as though a counter-protocolological practice might possibly be privileged as a solution to global horror, but I digress and I won't get too deep into that. Nevertheless, others claim that with the right tools, quantitative data analysis will illuminate all that had previously gone unnoticed in the humanities. Directly responding to these currents, my research turns then to the little database as an integral model for understanding our place in a rapidly changing information environment. This image isn't showing up very well, but it's a map of the internet. Instead of all of the internet or a million books, I'm interested in ordinary collections and everyday publications. So you can imagine a private collection of several thousand MP3 files. I imagine everyone has like a messy collection of MP3 files somewhere on their hard drives, or a website with a few thousand digitized books, or I imagine most of you have folders with PDFs with a variety of names. I'm just in trying to make sense of what these little collections mean and how we understand them. A little database then is at once too large to read in a traditional way, and at the same time small enough to be imminently computable and absolutely ordinary. So all of this is toward a politics and poetics of use in the daily experience of media, art, and literature in a steady kind of ambivalence, which is a term I'm borrowing from Patrick Jagoda, which I think might be a useful counter to Galloway's formulation in relationship to the determining structures of protocol. So these objects are bound by protocol, but their poetics extend beyond the situation. I'm also using the term little database, on the other hand, to index the little magazine. So like the little magazines of the historical avant-gardes, the little databases of the present offer a dynamic forum for investigating the global situation of politics, aesthetics, and meaning in a time of pervasive technological change, right? The little magazines were the bearer of modernity and modernism. The methodological challenges faced by periodical studies, where a full run of a little magazine, which is never quite little, can number hundreds of issues containing thousands of individual works in a wide variety of genres. This is just a map of some of the genres in The Egoist, and you can see it already gets quite complex even within the little magazine. And I think that this kind of mapping also aligns with websites like PenSound or UbuWeb, which periodically publish new and archival content via common internet protocols. Moreover, importing the study of these websites into the context of little magazines offers a kind of backdoor entry into a longer history of textual studies and editorial theory. So this, for me, is a way to reroute the forensic materiality of textuality studies that they've introduced into born digital objects as a way to study significant historical works that just happen to be circulating online. Okay, so to get at the textual condition that I just mentioned of digital republications, I've been moving into the study of variable formats. And this is really sort of dumb schematic work here. For most, of course, the term digitization conjures up this unidirectional process, a move from analog to digital media. Of course, this has never been the case, and I'm in good company here thinking about the post-digital at the Publishing Sphere Conference, where we see objects moving multi-directionally among various media, digital and analog alike. The digital versions of the works I study also transform understanding of previous media iterations, bringing to light previously unanticipated and fully contingent qualities and affordances of historical works. In both directions, I'm reading the digital object as a significant cultural artifact with its own systems of meaning. So I think often when we encounter an MP3 file or a crummy flash video, we want to discard it as a kind of degraded pile of pixels that doesn't line up with the actual aesthetic object, the painting, the film, and so on. I'm more interested in trying to take these things seriously, right? What would it mean to take brackage on YouTube seriously as something that we actually encounter? So I'll return to this point in a discussion of a single file, William Carlos Williams's Defective Record, in a moment, which is a very rare poetry recording which exponentially more listeners have encountered as an MP3 file than ever heard the original recording. I think this is often the case with our cultural objects now. Many, many more people are encountering these things exclusively through digital protocols and not in the original analog format. Okay, so if that's one dimension of variable formats, another way we can think about variable formats concerns the performance of scholarship. So in the same unidirectional passage, we often think of scholarship as an academic paper or an academic presentation like this one, which I'm giving to you, simply addressing the media as an external object. Instead, I'm interested in how we might imagine a media performing scholarship. This follows a trend in digital humanities toward building or constructing knowledge as scholarly practice. And I think most famously this is articulated by Jerome McGann and Lisa Samuels as a kind of deformance, they define this as an academic performance that works within historical materials to surface unseen aspects of the work. Though their imagination of this approach is simply to like turn Emily Dickinson backwards, which I think is a little bit limiting. I'm more interested in exploring between genres where I think our best poets and artists are also great digital humanities scholars. And a great work of scholarship should approach the category of a poem or an artwork. Here, finally, I'm getting to the poetics in my title. In his Apoetics, Charles Bernstein describes apoetics as, quote, the continuation of poetry by other means, end quote. In my research, I'm trying to extend Bernstein's formulation to include, quote, the continuation of scholarship by other means. So no longer relegated to the aesthetic wing of the Hall of Knowledge, poetry can become a kind of active agent in the construction of our understanding of the world, an agent that operates within the ordinary media and protocols that users encounter every day, every time you open up your console. Okay, so let me jump into just a few quick examples before wrapping up. A perfect example actually could be Grigor's, our final speaker's, incredible remediation of On the Road, and I like that this continues the road trip theme, which was completely unanticipated on my end, where he used Google Map directions to remap the full novel, which I had the privilege of publishing some 3 years ago as part of a project in Zurich, 1,000 books by 1,000 poets, of which this was the first. Now, of course, for Grigor and for this project, the book was coded as poetry, but I think it could equally be seen as a very serious and in-depth scholarly project on Kerouac. I actually wrote those words, having no idea that Marcello would be proposing just such a crazy way of doing a kind of scholarship of a road trip, and indeed, I think we can still call this scholarly. The ambivalence here between genres is also the poetics of format in the publishing sphere, I think, under protocol and networked culture. So, two brief further examples. The first, to be quick and punchy and try to get to what I'm saying in another genre. One of my favorite examples of trying to explain the kinds of research that I'm doing concerns a Paul Sherritt's film called Dots from 1964 to 1965. This is a Flux film that was displayed in various avant-garde movie theaters in the 60s. It was made very simply, so it was a kind of structural film. Each slide of the film was just a random matrix of dots, and they would flicker. Right, so if you were sitting in the cinema, if we weren't staring at this digital screen in a kind of half-lit room, but we're in the dark together, and we had this flickering of dots, this kind of overwhelming, transcendent experience of cinema, right? Capital C cinema. And actually, the film induced a number of seizures in viewers and caused a minor scandal in New York City when it was released. So if that was Dots in 1965, what we see here, and this is a screen capture of Dots, is actually just a series of blotchy squares, right? So the film's one title, its one function has been literally flipped on its head. The dots have become squares, and the original effects and intent of the piece, the cinematic overwhelmingness, has just become a kind of blurry mixing of squares. But I think this actually tells us something very interesting about protocol. This actually tells us how flash video functions, for example. Flash video maps images through continuous movement, so it's very good at watching me walk across a room because they just have to make the pixels move as I do. It's very bad at quick cuts. And this is what makes the compression function. So what Dots does is in its destruction, it actually reveals the protocols that undergird the flash videos that we encounter every day. Okay. But of course, Dots is just one transformation among many. And you could do that kind of reading of these kinds of unanticipated, fully contingent effects across a huge collection like Ubu Web, each of which would respond differently to flash video and computational use. I've detailed this extensively in a series of creative works called Flash Artifacts, which just gathers up instances of media-specific film and video in particular to surface the transformations that are rooted in everything from context and dispersion to attention and brute materiality, but I think that's far beyond the time limits of my talk today. To conclude, I thought we could just get into a close reading, which I was actually kind of, as an English scholar, kind of delighted that hasn't happened at all. And I think that sometimes it's sort of entertaining to go back and do a kind of close reading, very old-fashioned, right? I wanted to think about this poem, The Defective Record, by William Carlos Williams. This is a poem that demands the concept of the gramophone even from the page. There's already a great deal that we can read here, right? So Williams is describing, hopefully you've had a moment to sort of read through it, the destruction of marshland alongside a river that's being destroyed in order to put in a housing development. His description proceeds in characteristic variable foot meter with half rhymes that are interlaced throughout, right? So you have half rhymes with like cut, dumped, dump, pumped, or fill, killing, including skullcap. We could read this through an eco-poetic lens, where Williams' lament of industry in the New Jersey marshland comes into focus, killing whatever was there before, right? The destructive forces of industry. Beyond a close reading of the page, we could also read this poem and historically situate it. It was rejected by the Partisan Review in 1938, which is part of this grand and quite hilarious intra-left political fracas that Williams was caught up in. But no one has any time for that. And in the limited time that I have, I really wanted to focus more on the audio file and the final lines of the poem in particular, so we can just listen to this rather briefly.
The defective record. Cut the bank for the fill. Dump sand pumped out of the river into the old swale. Killing whatever was there before, including even the muskrat. Who did it? There's the guy, him in the blue shirt and turquoise skullcap. Level it down for him to build a house on, 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 to...
Okay. So you probably get where I'm going with this. Uncharacteristically in the spoken performance, Williams, he never really does this, completely ignores the line breaks of his printed version and instead amplifies the metaphor of a scratched gramophone by mimicking his own vocal patterns in the final phrase. One can imagine, if possible, a confused listener in 1942 when this was recorded, jumping up and running to the Victrola, imagining that perhaps it was broken and that the record was actually skipping, right? Why else would the esteemed Dr. Williams start skipping, but it would be some kind of mechanical failure of the gramophone? And so I think the poem as a recording, and it's the only time that it was published, actually calls the skipping record into conversation with the destructive forces of mechanical reproduction, right? It becomes a very potent media-specific gesture about the gramophone itself, about vinyl and the ways in which the record is produced being related to the content of the poem. So calling up the rhythmically violent gestures of ecological devastation, for example. And indeed, I think all of these readings that I've just offered could be embedded within the playback of the recording, and given proper time, I could lecture about them at length. Again, there's not really time for that. Instead, listening to the defective record today, transcoded as an MP3 file, say you were browsing PenSound or assigned it on a syllabus, here it's visualized both as a waveform and a spectrogram in Adobe Audition. This modulates Williams's media reflexive gesture, right? The modulation of the digital file accents both the medial origin, you all heard the crackling of the record, so it kind of indexes in an uncanny way a previous media, as well as the object's digital formatting. Right, MP3s don't skip like that. That's kind of clear to everybody. So in other words, the media reflexive gesture of the recording simultaneously amplifies both the conditions of its recording and its new status as a digital file. The sample-based structure is now built on segmented data, dramatically leveling the wave-like stream of the analog wax groove and contradicting the originally plotted effects of the poem with regard both to its politics and its aesthetics. Both of these have been flipped on their head. The metaphor of the scratched record is itself rendered defective in the face of digital playback. So if there are, quote, no ideas but in things, end quote, as Williams so famously claimed, we might ask what happens to the ideas of the works we encounter when the things themselves rematerialize through digital republication. unlike the anticipatory readings performed by literary studies or media archaeology that return to the latent potential inherent to the historical works, trying to indexically project ourselves into the past, I argue that a poetics of digital publication demands a study of the poem as a functioning new media object operating within the parameters of its digital format and new media context. Thank you.
So Lionel had to go and prepare something with Camille de Toledo for tonight, so he told me to take over and to try to be the moderator, so extempore. And so first I would ask whether you have questions, and if not, I have a few. Okay. So would you be prepared to... I was fascinated by your idea of being interested in seeing how a media performs scholarship, and this is something that I'm also very much interested in. And would you be somehow prepared to say that this could be included in a larger project that one might call practice-based criticism, for instance, where looking at... publishing, for instance, or translation, mm-hmm. Would be seen as categories of scholarship or producing scholarship. And indeed, when you presented your project listing all the addresses and so on and so forth, that's what a scholar does, you know, creating lists, mm-hmm. indexes, and mapping the territory. So indeed, would you see it as a larger, you know, fitting a larger category of practice-based criticism?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Is this picking up? So the project is actually embedded in thinking about editing in particular, right? So the little magazine editor as a kind of creative force. And it's a kind of weak and dispersed authorship. So it's not the author of the writer penning a poem by hand. But it's also not the kind of authorship that we assign to software formats and other things. It's a kind of loose editorial way of moving through text. And I'm actually very interested in trying to use that as a framework to think about things like conceptual writing, to think about things like remaking or remix. All of these actually could be folded into a much older understanding of practice-based criticism, of things like editors or translators, of which we actually have a very robust vocabulary, right? People have been debating how to remix and reuse Shakespeare for 400 years. It seems like we might be able to adopt some of that language when thinking about Rob Vitterman drawing from teenage Tumblr blogs, right? So yeah, I'm very interested in intergeneric playing between genres. I do this in my own practice, so I have a full article on Pensound that looks at these kinds of instances. And that's accompanied by an audio essay that edits together 40 different voices, media reflexive moments in the Pensound collection where it seems like the files are speaking very unintendedly to their new digital context. And this happens in a number of ways. So that creative work is scholarship, and I would submit it as scholarship. There's also a kind of way in which as a scholar, I can point to artists, I point to Grigor's work and say, this is good scholarship, right? One of my favorites, my friend Holly Melgard, published an amazing book called The Making of the Americans, instead of The Making of Americans, where she took Gertrude Stein's dictum that there is no such thing as repetition seriously. And so it was a very simple book to make. She kept the first instance of every word and then cut out everyone afterwards. Right, so you get the first the, and then the rest of the other thes and 900 pages of Gertrude Stein's epic tome are gone. And what you quickly find is that Gertrude Stein has an incredibly robust vocabulary. Right, by the time it makes sense for the first sentence or two, it's like, oh, that's Gertrude Stein, right? And then by the second page, it's getting a little weird, and it's got some adjectives. And you're like, oh, this feels a little weird. This isn't the Stein I know. Where are all the nouns at? And then by the 10th page already, there's this incredibly complex lexicon of verbal oddities. And so Holly published this on Troll Thread as a poem. But I think it's very easy for all of us in the room who might have some familiarity with Stein to say, wow, that's a great work of Stein scholarship that actually does the job better than me trying to write 15 pages about how Gertrude Stein actually surprisingly has a good lexicon.
Other question?
What used to be big is now maybe 10, 20, 30 years later, relatively small. So if we're talking about data sets, there must be that time element too in your work or the way you look at it. And I wonder these days, could we look at this very odd one-off website like Napster as a relatively small data set? Or, the weird approaches in the 90s when it comes to turning the whole internet into a directory structure, like Yahoo once started, right? Relatively small data set, by the way, these days. I just wonder, because you looked at the little database as a personal thing, but maybe we could look at the collective data sets from a similar...
Yeah, I think all those things you mentioned would definitely fit inside of that console in front of you, right? And so when I say little, and this is part of where I'm leaning on periodical studies and the study of the little magazine, right? These are big, difficult texts, right? So if you imagine you have say 60 years of little review, and you're trying to analyze it, how do you write about a magazine like Little Review, which has letters to the editor, it's got advertisements, it's got poems and fiction and masthead. It has a very wide range of textual genres all combined together, very much, you might say, like the internet. And so there's a field of study that's been developed to try to understand something like that. So it's little in that sense, because it's not big. When we think about big data, we're talking about Twitter, which generates untold numbers of terabytes or what have you. I forget the latest statistics. Or places like Prism, Google Books, which tries to get all the books. I mean, that would be big data. Little data is still sizable, right? Like it's not looking at a single book. But at a level in which is very recognizable as something that we might encounter every day. And this is where I think that these websites are useful, because they're public, they're published websites that we can all access, they're open access online, but they perform the same kind of scalar collection aspect that we have with our own small collections within our folders on our hard drives. If most people have downloading habits like I do. Then I imagine your hard drives look quite a bit like the subdirectories of PenSound, which are a complete mess, like really, really, really poorly organized.
Yeah, I would like to go back to the question of scholarship or critical scholarship. So that Vincent and Hans mentioned. So what do you see is the meaning of critical in that? Because for me, I think that quite often the archival or editorial publishing process is quite affirmative. And like you said, also David said about Goldsmith, that he doesn't want to take a stand, in a way, in the debates or in the disputes. So do you think that the critical means the same thing as it used to in this context, or does it get a new meaning, or should we get rid of the concept of critique?
Very good question. I think that there's various modes of critical operations that this kind of work does, right? I'm thinking about POC zines, which is a great little database that I've been studying, where the critical activity is actually to surface voices or to put attention onto voices that are otherwise marginalized, right? And a lot of these works, I think, inherent in the long history of conceptual and appropriation art is to reuse historical materials as a way to critique the, whether if it's the pictures generation, it's re-photography as a way to critique mass advertisement. And the examples would proliferate from there. So there, I think that there's always a kind of critical function to editing and selecting and moving texts around. I don't see that that's gone anywhere. And if anything, I think it's more important in thinking about editing, because the ethics of appropriation, right, in the conversation around Kenny, the ethics of use actually come to the foreground. So unlike when you're sort of writing freehand or writing an essay, I mean, any of us can write an essay on anything we want. But if we were to appropriate something, we might have to really consider our embodiment and our identities and our actual place as a human in order to think about how we're going to reuse those materials. So in some ways, I think it gets closer to those questions of what it means to use, to navigate, and to engage with critical histories, or to engage with history in a critical way. Does that get to your question? A little bit? Yeah, we can talk more.
Last question for Anna.
And my question is, how would you call then what I do when I do a close reading of Holger Honig-Melgaard's work with Gertrude Stein?
Oh, your task hasn't gone anywhere, right? I mean, these are different genres, right? So I'm a big proponent of playing and performing within genres and stretching the limits of what genres can do. There's something that you can do in the essay in a very established mode that Holly Melgaard can't do, right? And so it would be about thinking toward what is specific to the essay. When you say scholarship, I presume that's what you mean. But you're also, you know, an esteemed editor, and I would call that a part of your scholarly output as well. What is it that the essay can do that something like that couldn't do? And I think by reversing the question in that way, it could actually be revitalization of the essay, right? So leaning heavily on footnotes and the various linking functions that essays do very, very well, that a creative work like that doesn't. Leaning on the kind of plays with prose and style and absorption, right? Holly Melgaard's text is not absorptive. And speaks to, you know, an audience of experimental poetry weirdos like myself, but certainly wouldn't convince a number of my colleagues in the English department, right? So there's different rhetorical functions and different uses to each genre, and so I'm interested in playing among them. But I don't think that we need to cast Holly out. So I'm being a bit more inclusive, I think. And this is something about the internet as well, right? Everything is additive. Whenever I'm asked about every chapter that I wrote in this manuscript has a creative component that came afterward, and neither of them really supersede each other. They're just additive, and I don't think there's any reason to cut things away. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Benny. We're now moving to the last talk of the day. The speaker is Gregor Beisprott. He lives and works in Berlin. In spring 2015, he completed his studies in communication design at the University of Applied Sciences in Berlin. His work focuses on the recontextualization of the texts by which he finds himself surrounded. In fall 2014, together with Hannes Bayer, he founded the literary collective 0x0A for conceptual digital literature.
So, hello. My name is Gregor Weichbrot, and first of all, thanks for inviting me. I feel honored, also a little bit intimidated, but I think we get along. I was thinking about how to structure my presentation. Obviously, you might guess from the title that you're now getting a lecture from me, but it's not the case. I'm showing you practical, I'm showing you a collection of work I did in the past, and it's also not about writing books, because I don't write books, I let them write. So, and I was thinking about how to structure my presentation, and I thought I might just begin at the beginning. That was in 2011, because I was unaware of conceptualism or conceptual literature. So my starting point was a task at university in the second semester, And the task was to create a book in 1 month where it's not about the content, but the surrounding of the book. So the layout, the typography, to choose the font, and so on. The class was called Typography and Layout at HTW Berlin. And we were thinking about what to put in this book. This is the wrong laptop. This is the right one. So this is the outcome of it. And what we basically did was we wanted to transcribe a TV show. And we thought about talk shows because we were interested in we thought natural language, but later we found out they're all scripted. We didn't know. We showed that to our class, and they said, yeah, talk shows are not interesting anymore. So, and then we tried different shows, and then my partner came up with the idea to type of Germany's Next Top Model. And so we tried it out, and I put the headphones on my head, and I started to type off the show, and it was fun from the very first beginning, and we continued to do it. It took us about 20 hours or so, and we did this book, and we designed it in the guise of the classical Reklam drama books in Germany, those tiny drama books where you can usually find classical literature in, and that's how it looks. Very pretty. It's a quote from Heidi Klum. This is what she said. Yeah, also it had an index of all roles, like as I said, like in a classic drama. All the persons staging there. Also, we also included commercial breaks as a joke and filled them with abstract photography by a Berlin-based photographer. And divided the book in chapters. Yeah, this was somehow the starting point. It was very inspiring to me, and I wasn't at that time, as I said, I wasn't very aware of the projects that randomly appeared on my Twitter timeline, that they were connected to conceptualism or to conceptual art. So I got this book from my professor Birgit, who is here today, on creative writing by Kenneth Goldsmith, and it was very interesting to me because it matched matched to a lot of things that I was doing at that time. So in hindsight, you could think that I was trying to do as much books as possible, because the books I'm going to show you aren't very pretty, because they are done in a very short amount of time, because it was more about getting forward instead of being in despair. So the next one, the basic example or basic project is called Chicken Infinite. And the idea is basically, I think it comes from I realized my inability to read cooking recipes, because I would confuse them. I would confuse the steps of cooking recipes. You maybe find out, maybe you have this too, I don't know. And then I found out that the way cooking recipes are structured is that you can take out a sentence and put it somewhere else and it still works somehow. You can read it and you could take another step, skip three steps, and then you are still, if you don't follow it, you can be somewhere and you won't realize that you just lose connection to the content or to the meaning of the text. So what I did was I scraped a ton, I created a list of cooking recipe communities online, and I wrote a Python script it's a coding language that would scrape the contents of all those cooking recipes, and I had about a few hundreds or so, and told the Python script to split the text into sentences and randomly connect the sentences together, which would be in the end a cooking recipe for about 530 pages. The first 100 pages were the ingredients, of course, I spare you the 100 pages now. And this is the text, probably hard to read. So this goes on and on, 530 pages. Of course, it doesn't work because you have to be aware. You can't, for example, sentences like preheat the oven, you can't preheat the oven a dozen times. So you have to watch out for these sentences. Yeah, that was fun and simple and basic, rather basic. The next one is a collaboration with Vicky Burnett. I think I would do many things differently today, and the cover looks a little bit cheap. It's not my phone, it's the phone of the laptop here. Somebody's sending emojis. It's called, we call it Fundamental Questions, but I'm showing it to you because the reception was quite nice, or I also have a video from a person reading an excerpt from the text. And what I did there was I had an account at OkCupid, and I wrote a scraper that would download the texts, the self-descriptions of people from there, because I found them interesting to work with. And if you do this, I did this with about 553,000 of them. And when you sort them alphabetically, you would find sentences that would be the same. For example, like here, I was asking myself, why are people going to OkCupid? And I, of course, sorted the text alphabetically and then found sentences starting with why I am here. And I sent this over to Vicky. And she said, yeah, why I am here, that's like a fundamental question of life. She made a joke. Then I Googled it and found out the four fundamental questions of life. And we matched them according to match the text, the sentences according to the four questions, the four fundamental questions of life. Who am I? Where do I come from? What is my purpose in life? And what happens when I die? But at the chapter, What Happens When I Die, we included the text at the support page of OkCupid that explains to you what happens if you delete your account. So it's a little joke to digital death. This is Harty White, a.k.a. David Morris. No, the other way around. David Morris, a.k.a. Harty White. He's a radio host at WFMU. Who read it, and I thought I might show it to you.
I am an artist. I read, watch too much TV, play too many video games, and make plans to watch too many classic films that I never get around to. I am an artist, like art, even going to the opera, but also enjoy watching football. I am an artist, love painting and drawing, sculpture and photo. I am an artist, student, dreamer, doer, hard worker, jokester, sister, daughter, cousin, and friend. I am an artist, traveler, nature boy, and lover of life and all it entails. I am an artist, I am an artist, I am an artist, I am an artist, I am an artist. I am an artist. I am an artist, jewelry designer, and a small business owner. I am an artist, musician. I am an artist and a dreamer. I am an artist, and I'm lucky enough to get to do what I love. I am an artist and a photographer with a little bit of writer thrown in the mix. I am an artist and a photographer. I am an artist and a writer. I am an artist and a writer. I am an artist and counselor working with college students. I am an artist and crafter. I am an artist, and creating something new is always exciting. I am an artist and have a deep passion for sculpture and ceramics. I am an artist and have been drawing since I can remember. I am an artist and have the degrees to prove it. I am an artist and I just graduated from a college in Vermont. I am an artist and social worker. I am an artist and take that part of life very seriously. I am an artist and very passionate about it. I am an artist at heart, a photographer, a traveler, and a foodie. I am an artist at heart. I'm pretty down to earth. I am an artist at heart. I am an artist at heart and feel that it's important for everyone to have something that they are truly passionate about. I am an artist by trade and hobby, and I love being able to make a living with art. I am an artist creating artificial environments at zoos, aquariums, and parks. I am an artist first, musician second, art therapist third, regular boring 9-to-5 human last. I am an artist going to cosmetology school. I am an artistic creative person. I am an artist in a bit of a rut. I am an artist living in New York. I am an artist living in New York City. I am an artist of all different talents. I am an artist of sorts. I am an artist of sorts, though I've lacked inspiration recently. I am an artist primarily. I like all things intense and fun because YOLO. I am an artist who adores flowers. I am an artist who loves reading, learning, and living life to the fullest. I am an artist with a curiosity for life, people, and love. I am an artist with my MFA in printmaking. I am an art major focusing in drawing and ceramics. I am an arts lover, animal lover, and Liz Lemon lover, and I'm an art student. I am an art student. I am an artsy, talkative, and hardworking woman trying to make my small farm into something awesome. I'm an artsy kind of guy. I'm an artsy person. I draw and paint. I'm an artsy person with lots of opinions, and I'm very driven and ambitious. I'm an art teacher in a public school. I am an art therapist who loves that I get to spend my days in an art studio.
Yeah. Thanks to Hardy White. The next project is, Danny mentioned it, it's on the road. The story behind it is not so interesting. I was watching the movie adaptation of on the road, and I was not very, I was a little bored. But I was trying to cope with this boredom. So I was asking myself whether people would have already figured out which spots Kerouac, Jack Kerouac, traveled in his novel. So this is about the Jack Kerouac novel, which spots he traveled. And I looked at Google Maps, and there were, of course, like a bunch of, like a community of people sorting out the spots Kerouac traveled, but somehow nobody was taking the spots and putting them to the left top side of the screen into the input field for the route instructions. And I thought it might be a funny idea, so I found out this, to collect all the spots. There were about 150 or so, or 140 of them. So the geographical spots, the latitude and the longitude. I pressed on go and let myself output a route instruction for the text for the spots Kerouac traveled and matched it according to the four chapters also of the book. I think send it over to Kenneth Goldsmith, and he liked it also. Google showed that the journey takes 272 hours to travel for 17,527 miles. Yeah. So the next one is a little bit more, it's from the last year. It's deals with the Wikipedia, or specifically saying with a subpage of Wikipedia. It's called Articles for Deletion. The thing about the Wikipedia is that everybody can write. So nobody, you don't even have to set up an account. Everybody can write. Anonymous people can write. But because everybody can write, everybody does write. And because of that, people have to delete, because they have to sort out which knowledge is notable and which is not, which is interesting to read sometimes, because you can figure out the criteria for notable knowledge. They also do it with people's pages. And so this is the articles, for an example, a screenshot from the Articles for Deletion page. This is from June 7, 2017, and you have an index, and you see all the several pages that are nominated for deletion. So people nominate a page for deletion and discuss whether this should be removed or not, and decide whether it's notable or not. A lot of the times, the criteria is whether people are able to look it up on Google. So if you have a lot of hits on Google, you're relevant, you're notable. For example, here. Next, I form a discussion. So this is the introduction, my notable company. I found a few newspaper articles that mention the company, but these are all routine, and so on. And this is a little embarrassing. I got my own article got deleted in the German Wikipedia, and I think when your article is nominated for deletion, you would get such a banner on top of your page and a short explanation. And in this case, this is German. The translation might be completely misses notability criteria for authors, unsatisfying notability criteria for artists too. And I was thinking about how to be productive with this kind of experience. And so I thought I might not be alone. I might not be alone with my fate. And wrote again a Python script that would download the contents of the articles for deletion pages for the past 10 years and sort the outcome for artistic occupations. And it would create a kind of dedication to those people, those non-notable people, and call it a dictionary of non-notable artists, which includes the name of sorted alphabetically, sorted by occupation, and then sorted alphabetically, the name, and then the first sentence, which is most often the description or the explanation why this person is non-notable. And yeah, this is the contents, the index. Of the book, you see all the occupations, and there were some, because this is also a digital project, and I also publish everything online, let people download. There are reactions, positive reactions, not so interesting now, but there were some negative reactions. For example, one person, a Filipinian author, wrote a statement on his official statement on his Facebook page, and all of a sudden the discussion whether those people are notable or not, you would find on the article for the deletion pages, continued, but this time by the artists themselves. And I don't know, I wrote this person and explained to him that it was not my intention to annoy artists. Of course, there were two others. You got it wrong, but it was funny somehow. Also, when you read it, because the important thing, the good thing about the Wikipedia is you can look up everything, also the articles for deletion entries, and what he writes there is wrong. I looked it up. He didn't got defended by an American editor, but okay, let's not continue this discussion. So, the next one is a bot, and it's called Sündenbot. It's in German, but you might get the idea when I explain it to you. This is, I saw it as, I don't know, it was, I did it at the time when, during the US election phase, when all of a sudden, or for the first time in the German media, in the German press started to write about bots. And it never happened before. People weren't aware of bots. I think they are not more aware of bots, but because it's, to me, very unclear what a bot is. I think bot can, as you know, might be anything. But bots, of course, was like, it felt like would be the main point are bad. Like, it felt like there was a tendency to blame technology. So this was, to me, kind of a reaction to it. So this is because it's kind of dangerous. You can't blame about technology all the time, and at the same time wonder why, I don't know, something inventive doesn't appear in I don't know, why are we so dependent on those foreign companies? I don't know. I'm getting emotional talking about it. Because it's what I wanted to say. Sorry, my point was what I wanted to say. It's dangerous to complain about every time. I think because especially in this case, bots are useful and are not just bad because they are used in education to, for example, get people to learn coding language, which is interesting and which is important. And there is a bunch. There's a huge community online of people creating art bots that are very funny and yeah, like done by people that are not, I don't know, who are not in the know, who are just experimenting and want to try out computer language, which is a nice thing to do. So this bot basically also again scrapes the Wikipedia, but this time a list of disasters and picks out a disaster and creates, this is German, and creates an apology for the disaster. So I'm sorry, this is the English version. Yes, and it creates an apology. That's it. And posts the results to Twitter. So it picks out, for example, the eruption of the Sakurajima volcano between 1914 and 1915 in Japan and formulates an apology for it. And sometimes it would not apologize, but it's randomly. And it gets a little bit nasty. Sometimes that's it. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions to Gregor. Even though it was so pleasant to hear that we could stay with this smooth atmosphere. Yeah.
I just wanted to tell you, Mr. Weisbord, you're not the only one who is not registered. If it's Ernest, I don't know what you showed. I'm also an author, and I'm not at Wikipedia.
I don't know. Like, is it difficult for you that you, like, how do you plan to work? It seems like you just have, like, at some point an idea. Like, what do you do when you don't have an idea? Like, it seems like it always seems so, like, not random, but like it has like something has to happen all the time to find a new idea. Or it seems like, what do you do when you don't have an idea? Like, what do you do from day to day?
Jakob, this is boring. I wish I don't know, I work also, go to bed and eat.
Okay.
Thank you for this good question. Thank you for your answer. It was an afternoon under the auspice of Kenneth Goldsmith, and maybe we can move forward to the dinner, to the drinks, and to listen to Olga to know exactly what we are going to do.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that tonight is also the opening night of the film festival Rencontre Internationale between Paris and Berlin. It's curated by Nathalie Hénon and Jean-François Rettig. And it's actually at this very moment opening its doors for the whole week now in the auditorium. And from now, from 7, they'll show three surprise rare short films. So I don't know what it is. Then at 8:30, they screen Inverso Mundus by A.S. and F. And at 10, there's a multimedia concert by Thomas Köhner, and then there's a party. So we, as a group of conference participants, are going to have dinner now here in the Hirschfeld Bar. And actually, because we are less people than I expected, I invite all the speakers to invite other people if they know somebody to invite, or I will invite other people. And then we will have the reading by Camille de Toledo on the stage, basically, which we can look at from the dinner table. And then we will have two sessions of shared poetry readings by Thomas Böhm, which means we read poetry live together in two groups, one English, one German. So, guten Appetit.